Actually, if you look at all the planets in the solar system, every one of them is heating simultaneously. And there's certainly no other link to all those planets other than the sun itself. It's the one common cause we all have. And I heard it stated very clearly a few years ago by a scientist who said, we've been watching a North Polar Cap melt away over the last few years, and we know it isn't because of SUVs or fossil fuel consumption or any of the activities of humanity, because it's the North Polar Cap of Mars. So obviously, something's going on that's heating all the planets. It has to be common to the sun. So what we see is that we're in a period of time where it's relatively stable and the climate has been pretty good for us. But that hasn't been the case for most of Earth's history, and we're coming to a period where some of those changes are beginning to show up, and it worries people. About 8 years ago, the United Nations proposed limiting CO2 and reducing it to about 300 parts per million. Well, that would be an incredibly bad idea if we were capable of doing it. It would change the growth patterns of plants terribly. You see, it is plant food. Plant growth normally will expand to take it up, and we see direct evidence of that right now. But the one thing that stands in my mind is, for all the people yelling for regulation about CO2 and all the taxes they've collected over the many decades now over this growing concern about changes in the CO2 levels, I have never seen once a government program to plot about planting trees, big tracts of trees. It's a very simple solution.
After too much procrastination, finally the shop is up on sarahwestell.com with all of my favorite products and affiliates. Between this and Patreon donations, I can keep providing you with important independent reporting and interesting interviews. Products available include the skincare products I personally use, hemp oil infused with C60 serum and Defy Times TAM serum. Also, Tetragen's amazing weight loss product that gives you an industry-first, money-back guarantee because they know it works. Please visit my shop to support independent journalism and to get the absolute best products on the market. Also, for a limited time, be sure to download the free ebook, Water, How Water Connects All Living Things. Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. This episode, I have a genius scientist. His name is Charles Schulz coming to the program. And we're first going to talk about the whole Green New Deal and the hoax behind that. He's going to talk step by step on what's BS about it, what we can really do, what are the real issues we have, what is the BS issues, and then what we could do to solve the real issues and what isn't an issue. And it's just a definitive look at the whole global warming hoax, the Green New Deal hoax, and what really is true there. And then we get into life on Mars. He has a book about all the fossils that are found on Mars. It's almost a 500-page book about all the details and what he believes is the biology and the chemistry of it, you know, with pictures. Very interesting look at that. And then we talk about NASA and what's going on with NASA. They haven't been back out to the moon for decades, and what's really going on there. And we also talk about the massive gains in technology and AI, and just a fascinating discussion on where science is going, where the world is going, and the dark side and the really bright side of both. He's just brilliant, and it was a really fun conversation for me. And then he sticks around for my patrons and talks about the origin of the universe. And yes, a lot of it goes over my head, but that's okay. I have a lot of really smart listeners and smart patrons, and it probably won't go over your head. But I caught on to part of it, and just part of my, you know, plug in more of my understanding. And so it was really a fascinating discussion there too. So you can get that on Patreon. So let's get into my conversation with Charles Schulz. Hi, Charles. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here, Sarah.
I have heard you're the person I need to talk to on climate change and on all topics science, essentially. You have been on coast to coast about 45 times, I hear, and you are sought after everywhere. But I have one personal question I want to ask you first. Why is your name Sir Charles? Where'd the Sir come from?
There is a philanthropist, he's a Chinese-American businessman, who bought a barony in Scotland many years ago. And he used it to help promote people doing research that would be positive and beneficial for the world. and based on some research I did back in 92 to 94, he ended up conferring a knighthood on me and giving me a grant to cover my research for 5 years. And so I became officially Sir Charles of the Barony of Balclion in Aberdeenshire, Scotland.
Oh, that's awesome. And because he owns an island, and so it's a legit deal.
Well, actually, he owns the area around the castle, about 100,000 acres. It was the Leslie Baronage back then. And when he purchased it, he took on the title and is a member of Burke's peerage. He's listed in the peerage in the UK. So he's an actual landed titled baron.
It's not an island. He just owns so much land that he has the right to do stuff like that, knight people and so forth.
Pretty much, yes. It's covered by the original rules of Magna Carta allowed local barons to knight people into their service. And so this is how this all started.
Oh, that's great. Okay. I asked your wife about it and she said, ask you about it. So I did. I wanted to know what that was about. But really why I have you on is I want to talk about the Green New Deal and the climate change. Every scientist I know believes that it's a hoax. You know, obviously there are some issues. We have some pollution problems. We have animals that, especially the larger mammals that are in danger of going extinct. We have some issues, obviously. But this whole CO2 and the Green Deal and the earth heating up is one big hoax. The science is bogus from every scientist I've talked to. But I want to narrow down. I want to really dive into that and talk about it. The earth is heating up, but why is that? And is that anything special?
Actually, if you look at all the planets in the solar system, every one of them is heating simultaneously. And there's certainly no other link to all those planets other than the sun itself. It's the one common cause we all have. And I heard it stated very clearly a few years ago by a scientist who said, we've been watching a North Polar Cap melt away over the last few years, and we know it isn't because of SUVs or fossil fuel consumption or any of the activities of humanity, because it's the North Polar Cap of Mars. So obviously something's going on that's heating all the planets. It has to be common to the sun.
And what is it that's common to the sun? Is it also the distance, our distance from the sun, as well as, what is it?
Well, there's a number of things. The sun goes through cycles where its sunspots change. And when sunspots are at a minimum, we get cooler climates. And that's on an 11-year cycle. There are also cycles inside the sun that we don't know the origins of yet. Some of them take hundreds of years, some take thousands of years, and it changes how much energy is being emitted by the sun in terms of heat and light. So there are cycles that we don't understand, and we don't have the math to model them yet. We don't truly understand which direction it's changing, but we see that it changes constantly. Nothing is constant in our climate. It never has been. We've just been very fortunate to live in a relatively calm and benign period after the last ice age.
Well, I have this chart, I'm going to put it up here, and this chart shows that the Earth has been hotter 99,000, of the last 10,000 years, 9,900 of those years, it's been hotter than it is today. So that kind of makes you scratch your head and say, wait a minute, how can they be doing this alarming thing if the most of our history was hotter than it is today?
Well, a lot of it was. Now, we know that hasn't been the case always. We've had three periods of time, basically around 1350 and 1650 and 1850, where we had micro changes where the climate got very cold, the little ice age, as it's often referred to. And a lot of it was due to changes in sun cycle, in volcanic activity on the Earth, and weather patterns that cyclically change how much we get in terms of retained heat versus carbon dioxide growth. Many things change on a cyclic basis, but we can't even predict that yet. So what we see is that we're in a period of time where it's relatively stable and the climate has been pretty good for us, but that hasn't been the case for most of Earth's history. And we're coming to a period where some of those changes are beginning to show up, and it worries people. And there's certainly things that we should be worried about. One of the things we depend on is the ability to grow crops. And people are worried about changes in climate, changing how many crops we can grow and where. But if it comes back to the real sources of it all, there are changes in the Earth's position, its inclination, and its orbit that occur regularly. And these are also referred to as Milankovitch cycles. There are three of those that are at work in our world. Number one, the orbit of the Earth isn't a perfect circle, and it never was. It's an ellipse. But that ellipse changes in how eccentric it is, how broad it is. So how narrow or how broad that ellipse becomes over time is one of the primary elliptical or Milankovitch cycles, and it takes about 100,000 years. And we see that the ice ages of the last half million to a million years have been roughly 100,000 years apart, and that seems to lead us to believe there might be a connection. There's another Milankovitch cycle that is based on the fact that our axis is tilted right now at 23.5 degrees. If you look at the globe, there is the axis tilted off center, not truly vertical with respect to the sun. And that tilt changes how much sun we retain. Imagine if the axis were vertical, summers and winters would be almost identical in intensity and in duration. But if it's at an angle, we get more or less sunlight during each of those periods of season, and the weather becomes more variable over the course of the year. Well, our tipping of our pole changes constantly over thousands of years. And the third thing, the third Milankovitch cycle, is just as a top wobbles as it spins, the Earth is wobbling, and so the direction its axis points is scribing out a circle in the sky. And as this happens, this variation, which runs a few tens of thousands of years, has an effect on our climate as well. So we've got a number of things that we know change our climate constantly.
And can the climate change quickly? Can it happen like within a period of 10 years? Or, I mean, is it something that just happens, it's this gradual deal? Or is it kind of violent? Does it happen overnight kind of stuff? Overnight relatively to...
There are elements of both. No, it can happen very rapidly. One of the things that was remarkable when they were finding frozen mammoths years ago, they were studying them and they found that some still had daisies in their mouth that they were eating when they were frozen solid. And this seems to be rather strange. How does something freeze an animal that size right away? Well, it doesn't. I mean, it perhaps was stricken by weather that it didn't expect and it froze to death. But the fact is, it can happen in the space of years. Imagine if the Gulf Stream were to change the direction it's flowing, and it would change the amount of heat it carries to the northern United Kingdom. Well, then pretty soon they would have snow and ice like you wouldn't believe. And it's simply because the heat is being carried from the lower latitudes toward the equator up toward the north of the UK. So these shifts can happen very rapidly, and it changes when the density of salt water changes, when the heat of flow changes. Many things can change it.
So it's really not that, it's not that out of the normal what we're seeing. But let's talk about CO2, because the big concern is the CO2. They're talking about carbon tax. They're talking about re-engineering our entire economic system on CO2. What is your belief when it comes to CO2? My understanding is CO2 is plant food and we need CO2. What is your response when you hear about the reactions of CO2?
Well, you're absolutely right. And about 8 years ago, the United Nations proposed limiting CO2 and reducing it to about 300 parts per million. Well, that would be an incredibly bad idea if we were capable of doing it. It would change the growth patterns of plants terribly. You see, it is plant food. And CO2 shares a couple of interesting properties with other gases that can trap heat in our atmosphere, but it's the most prevalent one. And to put it in perspective, of all the carbon dioxide in our environment, 95% of it is generated and taken up by natural processes. All of the industries of man only use about 5% of the CO2 in the total environment. So we're contributing some CO2, absolutely, but it's basically at a small amount. Plant growth normally will expand to take it up, and we see direct evidence of that right now. But the one thing that stands in my mind is for all the people yelling for regulation about CO2 and all the taxes they've collected over the many decades now over this growing concern about changes in the CO2 levels, I have never seen once a government program to plot about planting trees, big tracts of trees. It's a very simple solution. We know that woody plants such as trees have the ability to sequester a lot of CO2 in their bark, in their wood, and in their roots. They had one year, I remember, a study where they couldn't keep track of 70 or 80 billion tons of CO2, and they found out that it ended up in the roots of pine trees. The root growth was amazing. So a lot of carbon dioxide is sunk in our environment and turned into biomass. Now, certainly we're making a difference, but I'd like to point out that termites, at one point, were putting more CO2 in our environment than all of our industries combined. And I don't think anybody would seriously say we need to kill all the termites.
Well, let me ask you then, what is your belief that is going on, because the central banks and the governments are talking about restructuring our entire economic system around companies that have a lower carbon, a zero carbon footprint, and rewarding them with getting access to credit. And those that have a carbon footprint will no longer have access to credit. So they're really playing some games here. And it seems almost like it's a dangerous game. And the least expensive, least disruptive, best thing for our world is just to plant trees. But are they really this ignorant? Or what's really going on? You know?
No, you know, obviously we know how to solve this problem. We know how to solve almost every problem we have. But the problem is regulations are in place in many cases that present that a lot of problems to having that happen. They prevent it from happening. And when you look at it, to put it in perspective, about $30 billion in a year's time could end world hunger. But every year we spend about $400 billion on climate-related issues and don't see any solid outcome from it. If they really wanted to start solving problems, they would plant trees, they would allow us to clean up the oceans, and they would allow us to do things along those lines. I have no problem with limiting the amount of CO2 a business produces. I mean, that's just good housekeeping. But when you start thinking about how it impacts lives, it's been suggested that much of the climate control issues that they put into place, some of the regulations they've made, have actually created a lot of misery and a lot of starvation. Now, if we're worried about CO2, plant things, absolutely. We should be turning desert areas into tree farms. And that's easy to do. We have the technology for it. But it all comes down to control. It's not about fixing things, because if it were really about fixing things, they would already be doing that.
Well, but it's one thing about reducing carbon footprint, you know, for maybe a high polluting company, but they're talking about getting rid of automobiles and totally restructuring our entire economic system that will cause misery and starvation. And they want to do this quickly. To me, it just seems like unnecessary expense, disruption, and misery when they could just go plant trees.
This is true. You know, removing internal combustion engines is not going to be the solution, and I'll tell you why. Everybody feels, oh, we go to electric vehicles, that'll be the end of it. Well, where does the electricity come from to run the vehicles? Instead of simply burning petroleum, now they're burning coal or other materials as well. Anytime we hear somebody saying, oh, we've got an all hydrogen powered vehicle or hydrogen powered system, nobody steps back and looks at the fact that to produce that hydrogen, somebody burned something. That hydrogen didn't just magically materialize out of nowhere. It took a power plant running something to make that hydrogen. And one of the other issues that most people won't face, solar panels can be a great asset to help us reduce our damage to the environment. For instance, it generally takes about 6 cubic meters of water for a power plant to produce and do the cooling to power a single home in the U.S. for one 24-hour period. So that's 6 cubic meters of water a day for each home in the U.S. based on what power plants consume. The average family in that home consumes about 1 cubic meter of water per day. So 6 cubic meters of water are going to keep your house in electrical power every day on average. If you go to solar panels, your water consumption for producing power drops to almost zero.
So what do you think is the solution? Plant trees?
Actually, there are a number of solutions. Yeah, absolutely. Let's plant trees, but let's also grow a lot of greenery. There are a lot of areas in many countries right now that, due to changes in the weather or the local climate, appear to be drying up and turning into desert areas. One of the simplest strategies, and one of the best ones I've heard, they take sewage and they compost it into the desert sand. And in a few months, that sand becomes fertile soil, and then you plant trees. And you can reclaim those desert areas and turn them into productive areas. And in a few years, you're producing not only trees and oxygen and wood, but you have areas that are, after a while, clean enough to start growing crops.
So it just seems like such an obvious thing, right? And it's so much better for everyone if you started doing that. It helps with hunger. I mean, it's just like you said, there's solutions and they're just not doing it. Let's talk about pollution, because we all know that pollution is a serious issue. What are the problems with pollution and how can we deal with it?
Okay, as you know, everything we produce in a machine generally creates some sort of a waste product. Most of our pollution comes from things like processing chemicals to produce fuels or lubricants or plastics. Some of the pollution comes from the drug industry or the chemical industries necessary to do processes such as producing paints and dyes. The biggest polluters right now appear to be agricultural products such as defoliants, pesticides, and fertilizers, because a lot of that material ends up running off into the bodies of water and it's very difficult to dispose of. You may remember years ago there was a huge push to get phosphates out of detergents because it was turning all the lakes and rivers into green scum. The algae was growing like crazy. Well, it was a type of fertilizer. So there are a lot of things we can do to eliminate that, but here's the root problem. Chemicals in our environment don't just sit there, they do something. And every living thing has a biological system inside it that processes molecules. It turns them into building materials, it produces the proteins, the enzymes, and the instructions that tell a cell how to operate. The chemicals in our environment naturally are things that we're adapted to handle and adapted to deal with. Stop and think for a moment what happens when we discard medications and they end up in the water system. Many of the molecules that are in common drugs, such as antidepressants or illegal drugs or growth hormones or things to treat the common cold, many of those molecules aren't produced in nature in any significant quantity or at all. So there are no metabolic breakdown pathways for those molecules. They end up in the system and they're floating around and nothing breaks them down and they end up cycling through our water in unpredicted ways. We don't know all the pathways yet. So what happens is these molecules get in your cells and they interpret them as instructions. They change how your cells operate. That's how cells communicate with each other, proteins and different molecules. So what's happening is the chemicals in our environment are changing how organisms live and respond and how resilient they are, and it's killing some of them.
And it's killing us too, right? I mean, our obesity rates are skyrocketing, our young are getting autism, our death age is lowering. What is this what's happening? I mean, is it all come?
Well, that's true. We have terrible problems in this country. I'd like to say, first of all, I saw an interesting cartoon a while back, and it was two cavemen sitting in a cave, and they were saying, you know, I don't understand it. We have plenty of fresh air, plenty of exercise, plenty of natural food, and we all die at age 30. It didn't really take into account the fact that there were other natural forces, such as being chased by a predator. Our society provides such an easy way of living and such an abundance of foods and materials that nobody really has a very tough time getting what they need. We tend to overeat. One of the other things about automation and having machinery is we don't expend as much energy getting a job done. Most of us lead very sedentary lives. We don't get much exercise. And one of the biggest problems in shorter lifespan is fat. Now, there's an interesting thing here. Fat cells are meant to store energy so that in lean times you can survive. The problem is many of the molecules that we're putting in the environment are trapped and retained in fat cells. So as you become obese, your body becomes a storehouse of toxins and molecules that were never meant to be there in the first place. When you start to lose weight or you start to get a little exercise, the toxins aren't necessarily lost. They can become concentrated in your system. Things that would have been below a certain threshold, might have just been a chronic or nagging sort of thing, can become serious. We see rates of cancer that are going through the roof. We see unspecified illnesses, pains and aches and inability to function. People just don't feel good in a lot of cases. They don't have the energy to get up and do anything. A lot of it can be attributed to exactly these molecules that we produce. They end up in our bodies. They end up trapped in the fat cells. If you look at the causes of cancer, fat and inactivity are right at the top of the list. I don't think that's a coincidence at all.
Well, do you think detoxing, you know, getting rid of your fat by exercising or doing whatever health, but also you have to detox then, because if you're going to be losing your fat and they're more concentrated, is detoxing really, really important?
I think that the concept is a great one. I'm not certain that any of the programs I've seen or heard of have been, I should say, properly vetted. We know that there are a lot of things that you can do to help. There are certain compounds that are often recommended if you're going through a loss of weight, like antioxidant compounds that help your body from destroying its own tissue. There's one called superoxide dismutase that occurs naturally in many cells. There are many others as well. I don't have enough technical expertise or knowledge to suggest what should be done, but I do know that if you are active to start with and stay that way, you're far less likely to have an issue here. I mean, think about our grandparents and great-grandparents. They used to be farmers. They'd eat bacon, they'd smoke, they'd drink whiskey, they'd be up at all hours, they work around the clock, and they lived to be 99 years old. You know, a lot of people say, today, if I go to the bank, I'm worn out. There's a lesson there. You have to eat less and just be active. That's your first line of defense. But really the solution is for us to find ways to get rid of these things in our environment. And there are technologies on the horizon that can do that.
For example?
Right now, they're working on certain types of filtration systems, things that can identify and tag a molecule, and even forms of nanotechnology that have the ability to locate and destroy these molecules. We're headed for a change that's going to be truly amazing. I don't think anybody is unfamiliar with the term the singularity. And I know this is a little bit off topic thread, but...
No, go ahead and talk about it, because we've talked about it a little bit. And you might have a different view of it, so keep talking.
Well, as many people know, if you look at the amount of human knowledge and the rate that it has grown, if you took all of the facts that people knew up to, say, year one, up to the year 1000, we will have found that that number of facts would have doubled. And by the year 1500, it would have doubled again. And you saw the Italian Renaissance. And by 1750... we saw changes in industrialization and automation. And it's really that the period of doubling human knowledge has been cutting in half all along. What people don't understand is with the addition of data processing and storage with computing and new technologies, it accelerates the rate of learning and accelerates the way of putting those facts together. Presently, we're in a period of time where the amount of human knowledge doubles in less than 9 months. So we're reaching the geometric growth portion of this trend. I would estimate between 15 and 20 years, something astounding will happen. We have no way of predicting what it will be, but many people believe that the growth of automated systems and AI and nanotechnology are going to converge to change the future into something we can't imagine.
Well, you know, I've had people, I don't know if you believe in remote viewing or not, but they've said the world is going to be so different that it's hard for people to even imagine the way. Then they don't, the people living then don't know any different. They just, it's part of their life, but we're all going to be connected together, be able to, you know, our brains are going to be connected. It's going to be a very different world. But,
you know, you hit on a very important point. Right now, we are connected together with our cell phones, and nobody seems to realize you basically have the ability to tap into the sum total of human knowledge with a device that fits in your pocket. And people sit there and watch cat videos. They don't understand that just about any question they have can be answered by that device. Now, having all of this information in our hands has changed our lives, and it's changed how we think. It doesn't necessarily mean it's any better or worse. It's just different. I think that really what's going to happen at this point is the connections we see will be smaller, faster, implantable type communication devices. Whether that's a good thing or not is completely debatable. But what I would say is this: we're going to see changes in materials and technology such as this. Imagine matter being controllable and smart and able to form or become anything you imagine. This is the sort of technology that's going to emerge. So you will have the ability to work more in information and controllable matter than anything else. Right now, we can see we're in the information age, and it's been growing like that for quite a while. But what happens next? It's the absolute control of the matter around you. This is one of the reasons when I talk about the climate change and the changes in our environment, I see actually a lot of hope that things are going to change radically. We are reaching a stage in our communication and our technology and other things that we're developing that we soon will have answers to all these things, and we can't allow regulations to stand in the way of implementing those suggestions or those solutions. I just talked to somebody recently who said he had solar panels on his house. During the hurricane, he wasn't allowed to use them afterwards.
Why?
To generate electrical power. Well, he bought a solar power system that he can't use to make electrical power because he was told by the local power company if he used it, there was a chance that he could put power back in the grid and electrocute workers trying to fix the lines. That's not possible. Every one of those systems has an internal disconnect that prevents that from happening. But by contract, they're not allowed to use their solar panels.
Yeah,
they
understand. Yeah, well, but they're getting to a point where they want to control everything about our lives. We're going in the opposite direction. And, you know, I'm on the fence with this. You know, I think that science can solve so many things. It's so beautiful. But science can also create so many problems. And a good example is organ transplants. It saved so many lives, but it also created this huge organ trafficking business. You know, I mean, so now they're going to try to grow organs, which would solve the organ trafficking problem. I don't know what other new problem is going to come out of growing organs. Maybe they'll end up growing weird creatures and abusing people. There's always this abuse.
You can count on it.
I know. But yeah, whatever you can think of, they'll do. And the only scary part is if the science can destroy our human being. You know, we have to somehow, we don't want to restrict advancement. I'm the last person that wants to restrict advancement, but we also have to be very aware of the issues that arise and then try to deal with it as they arise. Organ trafficking is absolutely flourishing, and the government powers are doing very little about it because they're making a lot of money, right? Science can solve the problem by creating growing organs. We have to have more values, more ethics, have more integrity in our systems so that we can let science flourish and then not be pushed down by the evils, the dark side of science. That's my take on it.
That's exactly it. You have hit the nail on the head, and that is that science as a discipline, there's nothing wrong with science as a discipline and as a pursuit. The problem is we don't apply ethics and we don't have any accountability. And, you know, human civilization depends on our ability to trust the intentions of our neighbor or at least learn what they are. And if they are dealing in science and they have no compunction about harming others, yes, you can make horrors. The whole point is anything can be turned into a weapon and anything can be made into a benefit. So it has to come with an understanding of ethics. I mean, why is it that you can go to any college and learn about science and physics and technology and medicine, but almost nobody sits you down and says, look, you've got a responsibility to other people when you live in any society. You've got to have ethics. It just astounds me that people don't consider that is the other face of the coin that makes it all work.
Exactly. It doesn't work without the other face of the coin. And you don't want to say, okay, I'm afraid that this is going to be like this, so we're going to shut down at all, which is what's going on now in a lot of places. You can't shut down. Now we don't have the ability to cure cancer, we do, but we're shutting down the ability to cure cancer and autism and all these things that scientists have the ability to do. And there's been so many promising ones, but they've been shutting it down. And that's the problem with regulation and everything else that you're talking about. The poor guy that wants to put solar on his house and he can't because some idiot made some rule that doesn't even make sense. That's technocracy. That's the control that we're that's barreling down on us. So we got to fight that while also erecting an ethical system. And it's fun talking to other people like that, like you, who are struggling to understand and communicate this to people, because it's the communication of it and getting people all mentally on the same page that this is how it works, guys. You can't shut it off or on. You got to implement it with these other ethical systems.
Sure, absolutely. The thing that strikes me is we have all this information, but we have less and less people who are educated and know how to think, how to perform, logical thinking, how to look at the facts, how to weigh them, how to see what the benefits or the problems might be. And You know, a lot of people seem to think that their ignorance is as good as our education, and that doesn't work. We're supposed to respect their what? The problem here is nobody recognizes that we are in a fight for survival. And they treat it as if it's a simple walk in the park. And they think that by giving responsibility to handle these problems off to somebody else, it's magically going to get done. And it doesn't happen. Perfect case in point, the water crisis in Flint or the sewage crisis in Montreal. Here we have taxes that were levied against the population to build a sewage treatment plant. We know how to do that. We know how it's done. It's not difficult. Somehow they're now out of money and they've gotten the ruling to allow them to discharge it right into the St. Lawrence River, a body of fresh water. You know, the people, and this has been said before, the people who are doing this have names and addresses. They have
exactly. We all have pitchforks.
You know, they took the money. They took the money from people. They have the technology. They spent it on development plans and stacks of paper and meetings. And in the end, nothing got built. The money went into pockets, and then they threw the sewage into the ocean. So I would like to make a point based on that. We're always told by these young, brilliantly educated, socialist-driven people coming out of the colleges, you old people wrecked everything. No, we did exactly what the law said. We took our trash to the curb. We put our stuff down the toilet. We put this where it belonged. We paid our taxes and our fees to have it handled properly. And then somewhere there was a handshake and an exchange of dollars. Nothing got done. And it got thrown away somewhere, and it's coming back to bite us. It isn't the common person who is wrecking the world.
Yes.
It is the corrupt politician, regulator, or business person, and we know who they are.
They must. Yep.
They must be held accountable. This will solve 90% of it right
off the bat. Blackmail corruption system. It's a little complicated, the justice system. But yes, it would solve. I always say getting rid of the corruption and the blackmail would solve 90% of our problems. I mean, just because suddenly all the people trying that have solutions that can get things done suddenly are no longer oppressed, their hands are no longer tied, and all the good people are unleashed to solve all the problems.
Well, and I see that there's going to be some sort of a new renaissance soon. There's got to be.
Well, let's talk about NASA, because you are a space scientist. Right. And you have done a lot of work on the solar system and space and the origins of the universe and all that. And you've been featured, like I said, 45 times on Coast to Coast, but you've been also featured on major networks and all over the place. And NASA, and at one point they recognized your work way at the beginning. And then I think, you know, you correct me if I'm wrong, but since then they've ignored your material. And, you know, And this is an and, because you can maybe get into all this stuff. They haven't been back to the moon for decades and decades. So there's something going on with NASA on top of them ignoring your material. What in the world is going on with NASA?
You know, sometimes in order to qualify what an illness is, you need to look at the symptoms. And when I look at what NASA has been doing, as a child, I revered them. They did amazing things. And over the years, I saw not so much, and then negative. And I've come to the conclusion that the people who really made NASA great are either dead or retired, and the people who are there now are simply warming their chairs. Over half of NASA are foreign people who have been hired to work with them. They are not Americans at all. And it astounds me the amount of people from China and India who are working in NASA. And we don't really seem to be seeing anything positive out of it. It's taken commercial spaceflight to bring them back to reality. It's grown to the point where it literally is a threat to them. They perceive it as a threat when, in fact, they should be working hand in hand. I would say that I first became aware of how bad it was in 1976 when Viking landed on Mars. And there's a scientist by the name of Dr. Gil Levin, who designed a biological detection package that was sent to Mars. Well, within a few hours of landing, the thing had shown what appeared to be signs of life, and they verified it on at least four occasions. And even the headlines on the paper in Jacksonville when I was a kid said, "Life on Mars." Well, they retracted it the next day. Now, Dr. Levin is certain he found biological activity. They had a machine on the rovers that said, no, we didn't find any biological molecules. Fact is, the machine was blind. It would have taken over 1 billion cells per sample. The machine was so terrible at finding biology. So now today, the fellow was 95 years old, and nobody's admitted that he found biology on Mars in 1976. Cut to 2004. I was doing some research. I'd written a few papers, and I found what appeared to be marine fossil remains. And the more I looked, the more certain I was. And I've presented a number of images of these things. I've done a number of shows on them. I've written a number of papers and even a book. And it's very clear, Mars, even though it's basically a horrid environment for life, actually supported some fairly complex life. And we find marine fossils all over the place. And it's hard for people to accept this because NASA won't say, yes, we've gotten into this herd mentality where unless it gets the holy blessing, it's not
exactly
acceptable.
Exactly. We know. I got to say something about that. We know that the news is fake. We've identified it in so many ways. But unless that fake news blesses it, it's not real. I'm like, what is going on here? Keep going.
Yes. Well, but the fact is, it gives us hope in a lot of ways. And realize the environment on Mars is just a small tip of the iceberg. There was very thin atmosphere pretty much always. The ocean was the surrogate atmosphere. Life can live in water because it exchanges the gases and provides everything they need. But what it means is that just about any world in the galaxy that's in just barely the right conditions might support a lot of life. And I would say that throughout the galaxy, throughout the universe, most life we find will probably be bacterial, because bacterial life is very simple and it grows rapidly. And on the average, bacterial forms evolve about 1 million times faster than larger life forms like humans or elephants or whales. So there's an easy way to see if these signatures are present. We look for certain types of molecules. We look for certain types of signatures. And we have the technology to do this. What's interesting is that since 1976, with all we have learned, not one single follow-up mission anywhere has carried life-detecting hardware. I would say, based on the evidence, if they really wanted to know the answer, they would have done it. And they failed to do it.
Yeah, so what's going on with NASA? It seems that they're lacking entrepreneur behavior, maybe, or they are just so
well
controlled, or, I mean, it just, that's why conspiracy theories thrive, because of what they're doing. And it's hard not to believe a conspiracy theory when they're so bad.
I understand that. And the one thing, and my wife has prompted me, I have to say this, we know that there was life on Mars, and we know that there was bacterial life, and nothing but nothing would have sterilized the entire planet. There are plans to send people there. There are plans to bring samples back. And I have to give the gravest warning, we would have absolutely no resistance to any sort of organism or bacterium or fungus or spore that might come back from Mars in a sample. And people say, well, you know, they'll put it in orbit. No, because things from the space station come back all the time. You can't possibly create, with our technology, a containment safe enough to contain those molecules, those organisms, and their products. I would like to also say, when the Columbia burned up, things that made it back to the ground from that spacecraft were body parts intact, notebooks with slightly scorched pages, nematode experiment, which had live organisms in it that landed on the ground, and they lived. A fiery reentry did not kill them. If that container had cracked open, those nematodes would have gotten in the soil and gone away. Wouldn't have been any harm, but the point remains that it would have been a vector for carrying a living organism that could have escaped into our environment. We've already seen many instances of this. So if we ever bring samples back, they must be isolated away from us and analyzed remotely. It makes no sense to expose our world to the sorts of dangers that could be brought back. And I think it is irresponsible for people to try to go to Mars with people knowing that if they ever had to come back, they could carry God knows what back with them.
Oh, it's almost, it's just like the diseases that came over and wiped out a lot of people, smallpox and whatever, that wiped out a lot of the indigenous
And
people.
that was done intentionally.
Well, I know.
Yes.
I've done
This is
shows on it.
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's, and this is one of the other things that strikes me. We seem to have leaders that have less than sterling character in a lot of ways. We need a way to know exactly what people's intentions are. And believe it or not, that technology is almost here.
Oh,
So,
yes,
if nothing
it
else.
Is here. Yeah, it's almost here. And then some people have that talent. I've talked to Sherry Edwards, who has the ability to hear. They've done tests on her, mini PBS specials. She has this weird ability to hear frequencies. So there are people that were just like innately born with this mutation. But they have taken that knowledge and analyzed it and created the technology so we know what. And then they also can tell brainwave patterns if someone's a psychopath and all sorts of things. And yeah, it's like, let's start. And the good thing is, if you can identify somebody as a psychopath when they're six or they're having that tendency to go in that direction, we can help them when they're little.
Remediation. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly right. Because a lot of the things that happen, we know, are the result of brain injury or a genetic damage or a chemical issue, a miswiring. We're at the borderline of technologies that will allow us to repair any of that stuff. And I say that, and it sounds a little outlandish. We already can take a biopsy of fat tissue from a person. We can turn it into stem cells of any class. We can clone them. We can use it to print organs, replacement tissue, and everything. The technology already exists, and it's being used in some countries. What that means is we are at the boundaries of being able to produce nearly immortal bodies for ourselves. I mean, this is coming.
Yes, it is.
And you're going to see people around you who are born today who may never die.
It's pretty weird. Now, that gets into, and I've had some conversations about the age of your soul, and your soul can't live in a body for a certain amount of time. And now you get into all sorts of interesting topics. But, you know, how long can your soul actually be in a body? You know, it's like, who knows? We don't know. But people think they know.
Well.
You know, but it's an interesting conversation because we can actually have it because it's something we can think about. But I think it's more interesting to think about the ethics of living older and what the heck happens to our planet and what are we going to do there?
Sure. And I think that the very first thing that becomes obvious is if people become immortal and they agree to become immortal, they would have to give up the right to reproduce.
You would have to give up the right to reproduce more than once or something. I don't know. The ethics of all that is pretty remarkable. I actually did a class at the university on the ethics of this. Now, the kids were not ready to talk about it at that level. You know, they were just trying to get their heads around the fact that this might be possible, let alone what are all the ethical ramifications of it. But it'll be a very serious area of study and how we deal with it. But, you know, right now we have so many other problems, and I think this dealing with the psychopaths and then not intentionally creating psychopaths, which is what they're doing.
Right.
So we got to make sure that doesn't happen. But you are just absolutely fascinating to talk to. This has been a great conversation. Can I, first of all, give people information, because you actually have a book on fossils of Mars and you have all this other stuff. Give us your spiel on what you have, and then I was hoping you could stay after and talk to my patrons on the origin of the universe or some other cool topic.
Okay, certainly. All right, well, I have three books that I've published, and the first is A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars, and that is available on my website, and it's over 400 pages. It's on CD, and it has so many pictures, so many illustrations of the things that have been found by the rovers and other spacecraft. And it goes into the chemistry, the history, the potential biology, and has many pictures of the fossils and where they were located. And I mean, I encourage people to look the material up, verify it for themselves. I'm not going to dictate what anybody should believe. I want people to know, not simply to believe. The second book is The Living Galaxy. And in it, I've written a treatise about what life would be like on some of the exoplanets, what life would be like in other solar systems, just how bizarre or different or Earth-like those places could be. And that book is also available on my website, and I believe you have the link for that, the Schultz Laboratories. And finally, I did write a science fiction that I published called Oneiros, and it has a little, it's actually based on the question of the Fermi paradox. Why don't we hear our neighbors? Where are they? And so that would be an interesting science fiction for somebody.
What do you mean, why don't we hear our neighbors? Is it the neighbors out there in the universe? Is that what you're talking about?
Okay. That's right, in the universe. There was a physicist by the name of Enrico Fermi who asked the question, you know, we know that life should be common, and we know that there should be technical races out there, so why don't we hear signals from our neighbors? And actually, there's some very good answers to that, but the book is based on that question. So it's a science fiction. I think you'll enjoy that.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, now where can they get those books?
All of them are available on SchultzLaboratories.com. There is a page that you go to that will take you to the book sales. There is a gallery of Mars fossils. And by the way, this is a three-dimensional website. It's a VR website. You navigate it on your computer, almost like a computer game. You use your arrow keys and your mouse to move around. And you can go into different galleries and areas and see things about nuclear physics, about the Mars fossils, about other subjects. And we're building a gallery there that will be an online virtual science center so people can learn skills and learn things about science and technology.
Okay, so the website, it's not available anywhere else like Amazon, just on your website?
We were on Amazon for a while, but you really don't make anything.
Amazon's not that great. No. Okay. Do you sign it for people?
I certainly could, but for the most part, I sell downloads. If they physically want hard copy, it would be on a CD. I could sign the disc for them, perhaps. But yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, and let's stick around for my Patreons.
Okay.